Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A typical morning in the Atlanta suburbs. Businessman Rusty Snyderman drops his beloved son off at the Dunwoody Prep Nursery. In the parking lot, a minivan pulls up next to his car. The driver pulls out a gun and shoots Rusty four times in the chest. Snyderman's devoted wife, Andrea, is devastated by the crime. Who could have done this? She is shocked when police trace the shooting to a man named Henry Newman, who happens to be Andrea's adoring boss. The prosecution accuses Andrea and Hemi, of having a forbidden relationship and of conspiring to collect $2 million in her husband's life insurance. But Andrea swears she never intended to kill Rusty, and it is Hemi who is delusional and obsessed. With the charges against her dropped and the insurance money frozen, Andrea remains a mysterious character. Only one other person, the man who pulled the trigger, knows the truth about what really happened. The book we're featuring this evening is Crazy for You, the true story of a family man's murder, a wife's secret, and a deadly obsession. With my special guest, journalist and author Michael Fleeman. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. Michael Fleeman.
Thanks, Dan. Happy to be here.
Thank you very much. First off, tell us a little bit about, set the stage with this Dunwoody Village. Tell us a little bit about Dunwoody and its proximity to Atlanta, and what kind of suburb is it really?
Yeah, I mean, Dunwoody is an upscale bedroom community, just on the perimeter loop, the freeway that runs around the Atlanta area. It's a place of very quiet trees, expensive houses, upper class, upper middle class families. It's a quiet, nice community.
Now, you open this right away with incredible action just before 9 a.m. on November 18th, 2010. And you open with a silver Infiniti G35, so a real nice car, pulled into Dunwoody Village Shopping Center. And in front of the wall of Dunwoody Prep Preschool. And you talk about Rusty Snyderman, 36 years old, and he's picking his three-year-old son up, or his three-year-old son had been in the car seat taking him to daycare. Tell us what happens shortly after.
Well, Rusty drops his son off at the Dunwoody Prep, very expensive prep school that's also a daycare center, and that should give you an idea of what kind of school it is. They're already thinking of college at age three, and he drops his son off and heads back toward the car, and just then a van pulls up, and out of the van emerges a man. He's wearing a stocking cap, and as you mentioned in the outset, he shoots Rusty right there in the parking lot in the morning, quiet day, four times, gets back in the van and takes off and disappears. And this is the kind of thing that has never happened anywhere in Dunwoody, much less in front of a preschool. And the preschool is located in a shopping center, so the post office is nearby, stores are nearby. Just right in the middle of the morning, this murder takes place.
Now, you talk about that there are various witnesses. There's a Craig Kuhlmeier. There's some people heard the pops. They give a general description that he's about 5'9" to maybe 5'11". There's varying reports. There's a beard. There's maybe a mustache. And there's this description of the silver minivan. What is the best lead that police have, and what do they do with Rusty Snyderman immediately?
Well, they don't have a lot of good leads in the beginning. Like you mentioned, the eyewitness accounts were kind of all over the map. They did have one eyewitness who got a good enough look at the gunman to provide a sketch, kind of a swarthy-looking man with a beard and a cap. But there isn't much, you know, there isn't much in the very beginning. And in fact, the scene is, you know, a little bit hysterical because not long after this happens, Rusty's wife, Andrea, shows up at the preschool. And you know, she's out of control. She's screaming. She's crying. What happened to my husband? What's going on here? And nobody would tell her. And so, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the shooting, of course, there's all these children there, and they have to worry about the kids. And so it's a rather chaotic scene at first, and nobody got a really good look at the gunman except to reveal that it's a man. But a lot of people did see the van, and it looked like a later model silver minivan.
Right. Now, how do paramedics and hospital staff deal with Rusty? What's the prognosis as soon as he gets there, and anything along the way that was interesting after he was shot?
Yeah, I mean, it looks pretty clear that he's dead, but they take him, you know, to the emergency room anyway, and work on him, and he's a goner. He's filled with these 40 caliber slugs. We're talking a major gun shot him, and they were unable to revive him, and he's declared dead at the hospital.
Now, you say that the police are on the way. They go to the crime scene. At first, there's some misunderstanding and misdirected call. It was referred to as an armed robbery, but they finally get there. What do they find in terms of shell casings or any kind of evidence other than the big, huge pool of blood, as you describe?
Well, they have. I'm trying to remember if they actually had the shell casings. You can probably help me out on this. But they have a guy lying in a pool of blood, pumped full of shots. And, you know, they have an aggrieved, you know, new, soon-to-be widow. They're trying to keep her away, you know, from the action and the scene. They're not telling her anything because, you know, frankly, nobody really knows too much about what's going on. And, you know, she's screaming and yelling, and you know, they're just really trying to contain things. But there's not a lot of physical evidence to work with at the scene.
Now, what is their procedure in terms of who do they talk to first and who are the detectives involved? You talk about DeKalb County. So who is involved in terms of jurisdiction here, and how do they proceed? Who do they speak to first?
Yeah, well, this is, you know, Dunwoody is a unique community. It's part of DeKalb County, but it's not a part of Atlanta. It is its own little city. And there's some sort of socioeconomic issues at work here. Atlanta, which has large African-American population, also has in places of the city crime. It's an urban center. Dunwoody is a very white community. It's also a community made up of a lot of, they call them, you know, Yankees, Northerners, who come to Atlanta, the Atlanta area, to work at the big, you know, Marietta, GE, to work at the big corporations there, and they huddle in Dunwoody. And so Dunwoody was recently incorporated, and it was sort of incorporated, you know, people tap dance around the issue, but the fact is this is a white community of people who are very concerned about Hispanic and African American criminals coming into their community, breaking into their cars, breaking into their house. So the police department is very community-oriented, very responsive to the community, and most of what they deal with is crime from the outside, as they call it. And they're not set up. They're not attuned. The entire city was not even founded on the very vague possibility that somebody within Dunwoody could commit a crime. So naturally, in the very beginning, the mindset is, you know, who came into Dunwoody and did this to Rusty Center? What sort of outside force could have happened? And so that was the mindset from the beginning of the investigation.
You talked, and this is a critical part of this book, too. You say that when the school had called Andrea, at first they didn't even tell her who was it involving. She later said she just assumed. But give us the details of what she was told, and then a phone call or phone calls that she made to the contrary.
Yeah, this would be very critical later on. Andrea, you know, was given, and there's some dispute about who said what to whom, but most, all of the witnesses are in agreement that Andrea got only the sketchiest of information, that her husband was dead, apparently a violent act, police were there, so she knows it wasn't, you know, heart attack or car accident or something, homicide. A detective sort of talks to her briefly, so she can assume that her husband had been killed, but nobody claimed to have told her how her husband was wounded. And keep in mind, in the beginning, he's only wounded. He's taken off to the hospital. Nobody even tells her that he's all but dead. She doesn't get the notification until hours later when she goes to the hospital. So, in fact, she's so frustrated by the lack of information that she's lashing out at people, and for years later she's complaining about how nobody would tell her anything. No one would tell her anything, and she's the wife, and she, you know, demands to know, which is, of course, natural. Yet in some critical phone calls early on, including one to her father-in-law and one to her close friend, she says, and I think to a coworker, she sent a text, to all of them she says, "My husband has been shot." Yet nobody told her. Nobody told her that he'd been shot. There was no obvious, you know, gun evidence on the ground that she could see. He could have been beaten to death. He could have been poisoned. He could have, any number of things could have happened. But she very clearly told several people he had been shot.
Now, when I asked you about the shells, there was shells left, but they couldn't narrow it down. It's either a 40 caliber or a 44 caliber, but ballistics couldn't narrow it down to make out the model of the gun, much less where or when it was purchased. So they did do an exhaustive search, but
yeah.
But tell us about the van. They had, at least they thought, more luck, and again, very, very interesting how much effort they put into this van.
Yeah, you know, there was, and we'll talk about it later, there was a lot of very bad police work done in this case. Dunwoody, like I said, was not equipped to handle a high-profile homicide. But there was a lot of good police work done, a lot of real intrepid shoe-leather police work, and this fell under that category. They had the van, and you know, they asked around everybody. They're trying to figure out who has this van, and it seemed like a needle in a haystack. But there was some security footage. There's security cameras all over the preschool. Now, the security cameras did not capture the actual shooting, but it did get footage of the van. And in some of the still photos that were enhanced from the security video, one of the cops said, "Hey, it looks like a sticker on the windshield." And they talked, "Well, why would there be a sticker on the windshield?" And this one officer said, "Well, maybe it was, you know, like when you rent a car at the airport or at the rental lot, isn't there a sticker that they put on the windshield, you know, the driver's side to kind of scan the car in and out?"
Right.
And the more they looked at it, the more they said, yeah, that looks like one of those rental car stickers. And first you have to get past the notion, well, who on earth would commit a murder in a rental car, rental van? But that turned out to be a big lead. So they were able to narrow the person driving the van from every single conceivable silver van in the world to silver vans that had been rented around the time of the shooting. And as they looked at it more detail, it appeared to be a Kia Sedona van, had that, those kinds of markings. So they were able to really narrow it down just by happenstance, just by somebody thinking a little outside the box. And so this is where the real detective work started, and they started calling, literally calling every rental agency in the area, asking if anybody had rented out a silver Kia Sedona or similar van around the time of this shooting.
You talk about some police work that wasn't up to standard, and you talk about just the politics of having basically your own police force, much different, and much different treatment of the citizens there, it seemed. You talk about the treatment of Andrea potentially as a suspect in this, and the sort of velvet glove treatment that she got. As well, she was offering advice to the officers, and
yeah,
they took her up on that advice. So what did she say to them? How was what was the content of what she had to say to them and her instructions as to the investigation?
Well, anybody with the most, you know, rudimentary knowledge of police work knows that when somebody is killed, you start with the people closest to them, and then you work your way out in concentric
sure.
circles. Not just murder, but, I mean, any crime. Because overwhelmingly, you get killed by people, you who know you, who are close to you. And the notion of a complete stranger driving up to you and shooting you in a parking lot is not just doesn't happen. So in the case of a husband or a wife, you always, always start with a spouse. They are the first person you have to eliminate. And, you know, cops talk in terms of not suspects, but in terms of eliminations. Everybody in the world is a suspect. Then you start eliminating people. And you have to start by eliminating those closest. So, Andrea is the wife. They very carefully did not tell her anything in the beginning, but they do have to talk to her. And not only would they have to eliminate her, but, you know, she would presumably know about enemies or problems or whatever. So she would also be the best witness to talk to. And a couple of detectives, and a more seasoned detective and a younger detective, go to the Snyderman house, beautiful, beautiful house in Dunwoody, knock on the door. And I think it was Andrea's mom comes to the door and says, the cops say, you know, we want to talk to Andrea about Miss Snyderman. You know, sorry for your loss. We want to talk to her about her husband's murder. And the mom says, come back tomorrow. She's not up to it. And the detective says, okay, I will. Now, if this had been a young African-American man from the inner city, I don't think he would have gotten that same deferential treatment. At least they would have pressed the matter a little bit. But they, from the very beginning, handled this thing with kid gloves. So they come back the next day, the two detectives, and that's when they talk to Andrea. Meanwhile, she's surrounded at a table by her family, her brother, who is a lawyer. And, again, it's a very, very deferential interview. Not that it has to be antagonistic or adversarial, but, you know, every cop knows that you have to eliminate the spouse. But they went into this, certainly one of the detectives, as if, look, you know, we got to be nice to her because this kind of thing just doesn't happen in Dunwoody. And so, you know, there wasn't a lot of attention paid to her from the very beginning.
They eventually ask her for permission to search, and or they get search warrants, and then they find a very, very interesting document if you were looking for motive potentially. Tell us about the life insurance policy that they found.
Yeah, I mean, they do the usual due diligence, and yeah, you know, Rusty's got a ton of life insurance. I don't remember what it is, over $1 million, I think.
Two.
It's certainly enough money, you know, to make for a murder motive. At the same time, you know, these are people of means, and you know, a large life insurance policy, and I think they both had life insurance policies, so would not be that unusual. But, you know, when you're talking a big, huge payout, you know, you really have to look at that. I think more important, what would prove more critical later on, was what Andrea did and did not tell them in this deferential interview. They're talking to her, and, you know, they're asking her the usual questions. Does he have any enemies, and, you know, anybody who might want to kill him? And she says, well, you know, she starts throwing out some possibilities. Rusty was in finance. He worked at a company, and, you know, they didn't part ways on particularly good terms, and she called the bosses a bunch of a-holes and, you know, kind of pointed to that. You know, she mentioned kind of casually, I think, like an exterminator had come by the house earlier, sort of thought, you know, that might be somebody. She mentioned that previous to that, Rusty had stumbled onto a guy who was sort of crouching behind the house by the air conditioning unit. She said it was a Mexican guy, you know, and that's kind of in Dunwoody code for, you know, possible criminals. So, you know, and she's, you know, sending them into these various investigative avenues. But at one point, and this is the most, what would prove to be the most critical point of the interview, they start asking the sort of routine question, you know, any problems in your marriage? No, we're very, very happily married. You know, they ask about their sex life, and, you know, everything's fine. And, you know, did he have an affair? No, I don't think he ever had any affairs. And then they ask her, well, has anybody ever expressed romantic interest in you? And Andrea got a little flustered, and she finally says, well, you know, and the cop says, well, do you want to talk about this privately? Because keep in mind, her mom is there, her brother's there. And Andrea's, no, I'll talk about this. And she says, well, you know, my boss once, you know, expressed feelings for me. But I very quickly shot it down. I'm happily married, and we're very respectful after that. You know, it's just one of the passing moment. And the mother jumped in and said, yeah, you know, tell her, you never reciprocated, right? And Andrea, no, I didn't, Mom. You know, it just happened. He's a very nice man. He expresses feelings. I said, you know, this could not go both ways. I married, and that was the end of it. And unfortunately, that was the end of it for a while because police did not follow up on that.
You talk about that they didn't have another official interview. It took a long time for them to have an interview at the police station, and that was very, very interesting. So they took her advice, and they went on and followed leads. They put out the sketch, and that generated some leads. They had to follow those to their logical conclusion. What do they? Before we talk again about how they eventually put this together with the, again, tracing it back to the van rental, but in the interim, what is the investigation and where is it focused on?
Yeah, well, they're looking mostly into Rusty's financial and work history. He was an MBA from Harvard, made a lot of money, but he had bounced around from job to job. And, you know, he, like I said, he left this one position under, you know, not very good circumstances. He then got involved. He was an entrepreneur. He then got involved in this sort of celebrity. It was a kind of complicated, but it's one of these things where if you have an answering machine or an answering message, you can get a celebrity to do your answering message. And he was trying to start up a, you know, so that George Clooney could answer your phone, you know, when you're not there. And he was trying to get that company off the ground. And, you know, police kept thinking, hey, maybe there's something in the business history. And they kept thinking it had all the sort of signs of an assassination, right? Like a hitman, that it was so brazen, middle of the morning, broad daylight, in front of a school, for heaven's sake. Calm, cool, collected. So they kept thinking this had to be a hit. And they really scoured his work history, looking for something. Did he cross somebody some way, litigation? And that's really what dedicated most of the police's work in the beginning.
Now, what did police do with the report, and how did they attribute it to this crime at all? Did they think it was connected when they looked at the police reports of the incident that happened with the homeless guy considered a Mexican with the mustache that Rusty had called 911 about?
Yeah, it just seemed kind of interesting, but I don't think in the beginning, it's this odd thing where Rusty saw this guy at the house and it was on the side of the house and then he ran off into the woods or something, and it's all very scary. But, he was a Mexican guy, didn't have a good ID. And I don't know that they were able initially to make much of it.
Right. You talk about the, again, incredible funeral, and this is a Jewish funeral, so you talk about some of the traditions. And Hemi attends the funeral. What is his role at the funeral, and what is his demeanor at that funeral? Again,
yeah, well,
maybe
so,
you could tell us.
Yeah, you remember that Andrea said, oh, my boss had expressed affection for me, but we put it aside and we moved on. Well, that same boss is Hemi Newman. And he did. He attended the funeral. He, seemed respectful he gave his condolences and it was, to people on the outside, it all seemed very appropriate.
Yeah, even shoveled dirt on the coffin.
Yeah, there's a tradition, these were very, very devout Jewish people, in the town of Dunwoody, that's a very, very tight-knit community, not a lot of Jewish people there, went back to the home and did the whole ceremony and all the traditions, and yeah, Hemi even shoveled dirt onto the coffin.
Right. Now let's get back to the van discovery, because again they start off with thinking that this might be a new van and it might be a Dodge Caravan, and then through this, again, very good police work, they narrow it down to this 2011 Sedona. So once they inadvertently bump into this Hemi Newman, and the other warrants come into play where for computers, and again, tell us about the process of them eventually getting around to looking at digital information.
Yeah.
All that phone call information.
Yeah, I mean, first the van, and they narrow it down, it took a while. They called a lot of rental places, and you see the security footage is not super clear, and it's hard to make things out, and you can't see the license plate and all that. And they get some help from other cops in the department, and they finally do trace the van. And a rental agency, I think it was an enterprise, outside of Atlanta. They did have a van, Kia Sedona, silver, did get rented out right around the time of I think this was November 18th, and I think the van was rented out the day before or something like that, and came back the next day, and it was rented out near, Dunwoody, and it's sitting here in the lot, if you want to take a look at it. It had out-of-state plates, but that's not unusual. Someone would rent a van one state and bring it back. And they said, fine, and the cops asked, okay, do you have the paperwork for when that van was originally rented? And, yeah, they had it. And do you have a contact phone number for the person who rented it? And yes, we do. And so the police pick up the phone and they call the cell phone number, the contact of the person who rented the van, and Hemi Newman answers the phone.
Now, there's, of course, a warrant for, like I say, his computer. They do start to investigate the connection because they realize where he works at GE, and he's the boss of Andrea Snyderman. And they speak to him as well, and they arrest him. This is the first time he's ever been arrested.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about just that first interview with him and what the police glean from that.
Yeah, it took a while. It took about a month, I think, before they put everything together with the van and Hemi. And even then, they didn't, you know, haul him into jail right away. Hemi was actually in Florida for somebody's funeral, I think. When they called him, and they gave him a week to come back. And, you know, again, very, very deferential. And, they bring Hemi into the station, and he really gets the third degree. This is a long, complicated, grueling interrogation. And it begins as not an interrogation, but just as questioning. But they reach a point where they want to read Hemi his rights. And when they do that, in real life, you actually sign a paper saying, you know, you understand these rights. And he kind of hemmed and hawed and didn't want to do it. And, he asked, do I need a lawyer? And, you know, once he gets a lawyer, that's it. So they sort of say, well, do you need a lawyer, you know? So that became very suspicious. And, you know, but he's agitated. He's, you know, he looks at things on videotape. You can watch it. And he looks, you know, he doesn't look like an innocent man. But they ask about his relationship with Andrea. And, you know, he says he has a lot of respect for her. And they also find out that he had met with her husband shortly before the murder, which was kind of odd. But, you know, Hemi's Jewish, and Rusty's Jewish, and Andrew's Jewish, and, you know, he was helping him with some business stuff, I think, he said. And, you know, but he steadfastly denied killing Rusty, but he did kind of tap dance around. It's like, well, why would I do that? You know, that kind of thing. Why would I do something so stupid? You know, so his answers, you know, while in the negative, were very suspicious. Now, they asked about the van, and he says, oh, you know, he had to bring in his car for some kind of warranty, recall work or something, and that's why they rented the van. And they asked for his, and this is where he got in trouble, they asked for his whereabouts the morning of the murder. He said, I was at work. And are you sure? And he said, yep, I was at work. Well, you know, he was so suspicious and acting so strange that they did actually arrest him and held him. And then they had to go about confirming or knocking down his alibi.
While they're doing that with the help of GE and also pings from a cell phone, records, those kinds of things. It's interesting and very, very telling, I think, is that Andrea is notified that the police have made an arrest, and I'm sure this is strategic. What is her response to just the statement that someone has been arrested in the murder of her husband?
She is acting about as guilty as Hemi is. And, you know, I think, and you may have to refresh my recollection on this, I think she said, is it Hemi? Or somehow brings up his name.
No, what she does do is she doesn't ask who it is.
That's right, she doesn't ask. She doesn't ask who it is. That's it. She doesn't ask the obvious questions. Right? If your husband got killed, who did it? You know, wouldn't you want to know? What happened?
Sure.
Blah, blah, blah. No, she doesn't ask. It's as if she knows. And she's just not, it's difficult to describe unless you hear her interviews, but she's just not acting like the aggrieved widow, you know, Or at least, oh, you know, we solved your husband's murder. You'd think she'd be overjoyed or wanting to help in any way, but she's evasive and defensive and just doesn't do the things or ask the kinds of questions that you would expect somebody in that position to do.
Yeah. You say right after the arrest, though, that this deputy chief Sides and Lieutenant Barnes, they talked to Andrea, and so there's a little bit more heat on her. So, and they're asking her things like, what do you think we found out?
Mm-hmm.
And so she tries to assume she might know the answer. She said, well, that he went crazy.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
She then starts
he's
talking
not,
about
he's crazy.
Something.
He loves me. What's wrong with him? I don't know. You know, you tell me, that kind of stuff. You know, it's the defiance. You know, it's as if it's like, lady, we're on the same page. We're on the same team as you. You know, why are you putting up all these roadblocks? Why are you giving us all this attitude? You know, what are you hiding? And you know, they're now having to pry information out of her. Now, look, to the very end, she said, look, I told him up front that Hemi expressed feelings for me. Not my fault you guys didn't follow up on it, you know. But now they are following up on it, and she's not helping them.
She is trying to protect herself, though, so she says that she received a... Again, when she was very shocked, this Bruno Mars iTunes gift,
yeah.
Just the Way
yeah,
You Are, so
like,
that just shocked her.
Some like love song, you know, while Hemi, after the murder, but it was after the murder and while Hemi was out and about, you know, he sends her like an iTunes love song, you know. I forgot the name of it. It's like I Love You or How Do I Love You or whatever. You know, and it's like, well, wait a second, lady. She's telling them this now, right, after the arrest. It's like, well, why didn't you tell us this sooner, you know? I mean, your husband's arrested. I mean, your husband's killed, and your boss is sending you love songs afterwards, and you know we're trying to find the person, and we already asked you, you know, if anybody was in love with you, and you downplayed it. But she does tell him because, you know, she's smart, and it's starting to dawn on her that, you know, they can search her phone. They can search her computer, although it's interesting to note that that first night, remember when they went to talk to her
sure.
And they had to come back the next day, they didn't seize her computer. They had 24 hours more to mess around with that computer. And so, you know, but she knows. She clearly knows. And so she tells them, yeah, my boss sent me this love song.
It's interesting, too, in this interview when she's receiving some heat. They certainly have a different attitude with her and much more confrontational. They say to her, listen, because her mother arrives at the police station, they say, listen, your mother is thinking that we're holding you hostage. Can you go out there and reassure her we aren't, and then we'll continue right after that?
Yeah, well, that
what
was
happened?
A mistake.
What happened?
Yeah, so near the end, they say, you know, look, your mom thinks we're holding you hostage. Go out there and tell her we're just having a conversation. She goes out there, and she never comes back. That's the last time she talks to cops.
Yeah, very, very interesting, that mother dynamic. Now, how do he gets a public defender right away, but
yeah.
Not for long, and somebody comes to the rescue here. Tell us what kind of his appearance in court, and then what happens as a result of getting a defense team together.
Yeah, so remember that the publicity, and this was a very highly publicized case, the world is expecting a hitman, a trained assassin. From the sketch, they're expecting maybe some hardened criminals or the Hispanic man. And what they get is this nerdy little gray-haired guy who works at General Electric. And he just looks, just doesn't, this isn't what anybody thought. This is a man pulling down close to $200,000 at GE, technical wizard, supervisor, very, very good position. And so he's just kind of, he's kind of sitting there sort of sad and forlorn in court. And it doesn't jibe with these preconceived ideas of what goes on in Dunwoody. He goes through the usual, not guilty stuff. But he does get private counsel, and they are very, very, very accomplished lawyers in Atlanta. And they are watching and becoming increasingly concerned with what police are digging up on Hemi Newman.
At the same time, they don't rest in terms of getting all the details. So they are amassing, like I had mentioned, all of the relative email evidence, card reading at GE to know when he came in, when he left. Tell us a little bit what is found eventually in terms of
well,
all
there's
this.
It kind of falls under two categories. The first is they got to look into his alibi. Well, I was at GE 20 whatever miles away in Marietta at the time. I was at GE when all this happened. So was Andrea. Or Andrea was on her way or something. Well, when you work at a big company like GE, it's kind of creepy, but they really sort of follow your every move. There's key cards that you have to swipe to get into the building, into different parts of the complex. GE even keeps track of when you turn on your computer, when you turn it off, and security cameras, all kinds of things, but mostly the key cards. And this initial phase one of the technical investigation found that Hemi could not account digitally, electronically, for his whereabouts at the time of the murder. In fact, all signs point to him not being there. And all kinds of weird stuff. Like normally he would swipe a card, but instead when he, at one point during the morning, he signs himself in, manually. Showed up at a different time in the morning. Basically, and it's very complicated, and they were using the tech, IT team at GE, but basically there was this big gap, plenty of time for him to have committed the murder and then gotten back to his office.
They eventually look at Hemi's cell phone records, and they recognize a name. Or they don't recognize the name, but when they contact this Jan De Silva, what does he tell them?
Yeah, they're going through his cell phone, and there's a lot of suspicious stuff on the phone. They don't have taps of the phone, but through subpoenas, by figuring out where, when you're near a cell phone tower, it pings the phone, they can kind of trace your movements. And they find a lot of interesting movements by Hemi. Number one, he was in the area of a gun show before the murder. He was in the area of a firing range before the murder. They were able to confirm that he was actually at the firing range. They were able to confirm he was actually at the gun show. This De Silva number comes up, and cops call this guy up and ask him, why are you talking to Hemi Newman? And he says, oh, I sold him a gun.
Yeah, and it's a Bursa Thunder 40 caliber semi-automatic.
Yeah, this is like an elephant gun. This is a big gun, 40 caliber, very similar, to the kind of gun that killed Rusty. The problem is they don't have it, right? Jan sold him the gun, but the gun is still missing. The cops are, oh boy, do you have any, the ballistics, they can, by looking at the sort of brass cartridges and the way that the firing pin hits the cartridges, they can make a match if they have a spent cartridge. And there were none at the scene. And, when they found out that Hemi went to the firing range, They went through thousands of spent cartridges, and none of them matched. You know, so they couldn't find it. And they asked Daniel, "Hey, you know, do you have any spent?" "No, I gave him the gun." He said, "Oh, wait a second. You know, when I first bought the gun, it came with one cartridge from a test fire, and I gave that cartridge to my girlfriend as a souvenir." And go boy. So the cops zip over to I think she was an ex-girlfriend at that point, zip over to the woman's house. "Did you keep the cartridge, please, please, please?" "Oh, yes, she did." And they look at the cartridge, they run ballistics, and sure enough, that was the gun that killed Rusty Steinerman.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Michael, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the leading meal kit delivery service in the U.S., and while many people know what they do, many don't know about the types of meals you eat when you cook with Blue Apron, like strip steaks with potatoes and spicy maple collard greens, a steakhouse-inspired favorite, with a delicious twist, chili-infused maple syrup. With incredible ingredients and chef-designed recipes like this, Blue Apron lets you see what the power of food can do. Blue Apron delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes right to your door that can be cooked in under 45 minutes. The menu changes every week based on what's in season and is designed by Blue Apron's in-house culinary team. Blue Apron offers 12 new recipes each week, and customers can pick 2, 3, or 4 recipes based on what best fits their schedule. Blue Apron sends only non-GMO ingredients and meat with no added hormones. Now, I tried just recently the salmon and spicy orange salsa with quinoa and carrot salad. I mean, even just the ingredients intrigued me. This was absolutely delicious. I made it myself. It didn't take much time. It worked out perfect. Now, basically, Blue Apron is treating True Murder listeners to your first 3 meals free if you visit blueapron.com/murder. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free at blueapron.com/murder. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now they have the confirmed weapon. They have now all kinds of other digital evidence. Tell us a little bit about what the credit card evidence tells them about the relationship with Hemi.
GE, turns out that Hemi had a corporate Amex card through GE. And Andrea had made reference earlier to when Hemi had expressed his feelings for her. She said it was during a business trip. And I think it was near Lake Tahoe or Nevada somewhere. And you know, turns out that Hemi and Andrea made several business trips together. Hemi was her boss. And not only did they make these business trips, but he put it all in the corporate Amex card. And we mean down to not just the hotels and the flight, but the wine that was purchased and the expensive meals that were purchased. And it was all documented, multiple business trips together, including one to London. And by kind of backtracking from the credit cards, they could call the hotels, the motels, the restaurants. And what emerged were not innocent little business trips. One of the business trips, North Carolina, they went to a club called Pulse Nightclub, and there they were slow dancing on the floor, and he's grabbing her butt or something. And another trip, they had adjoining rooms, and, you know, they talked to the front desk guy, and, you know, Hemi had called ahead and said, "Oh, my wife is coming. Tell her I love her." And then Andrea shows up. You know, late checkouts. You know, the credit card evidence painted the picture that any reasonable observer say they are clearly having an affair.
You also talk about that they dug up people, like you say, witnessed their behavior at this nightclub groping, but also that she had spoken to some of her friends and mentioned an affair. So there was quite a bit of contradictory evidence gathered against her official statements, even though they were limited.
Yeah, quite a bit. And, you know, and she also confided in a friend that things were not great with Rusty, and, you know, oh, everything's always about Rusty, and he always puts his career first and not mine, and, you know, just one thing after another didn't add up from what she had told police initially. Remember, from the very beginning, oh, my boss expressed feelings, and I said no, and that was the end of it. Well, she left out the part about the slow dancing at the nightclub and the, you know, romantic dinners with expensive wine and the adjoining rooms and, you know, all this other stuff.
Now, you talk about the media in 2011 in March revealed all the suspicion of Andrea officially and the connection before the correspondence between them before the murder and after the murder. So tell us what would the tone of the media coverage.
Yeah, the tone became increasingly the gist of the media coverage, because the media started getting a hold of some of the evidence as it was released through search warrants and other means. It was very clear that Andrea, that Andrea was having an affair, that she had either been evasive or lied about the affair, and that perhaps she had something to do with this. I mean, we go back to the first thing. Who's the first person you talk to? The spouse. And had Andrea, you know, recruited her boss, with whom she was having an affair, to kill her husband so she could run off with her boss and a ton of insurance money? And that was sort of the gist of the storyline. Eventually, cops were able to obtain the email correspondence between Andrea and Hemi. And, you know, it goes on for pages and pages and pages and pages, and it's hard to generalize it too much, but the point is they had a very, very, very close relationship. One that might have at many times seemed a little one-sided. Hemi was constantly expressing his love and devotion. I think at one point even proposed marriage to Andrea. Andrea seemed to waffle and at some point seemed to enjoy the attention and the affections of Hemi. At other times she seemed annoyed by him. She never said, "I love you." Other times, lots of expressions of guilt and anxiety about something. But they very clearly had a very close relationship that went much beyond boss and employee and went much beyond a one-time casual, "Oh, you know, I think I have feelings for you," which is how she originally had portrayed it.
Before we get to this trial, what did police find in terms of this? You talked about the continual correspondence and several emails and phone calls and text. But what about after the murder? What was that record like? What did they find in terms of that kind of evidence?
You're going to have to help me on this one. I can't remember what the main exactly what they found. I know right after the murder, that morning, Hemi is trying to call her and call her and call her and call her and call her. I mean, we're talking in the minutes after the murder. And at one point, she does talk to him. And we don't know what they said, but she's talking to this guy the morning of her husband's murder. And we don't know what it is, but it's very, very suspicious. So there's this sort of continuous contact between them right after that she also sort of left out.
And then there's a gap. And then there's this noticeable gap in the correspondence between them, at least officially, at least that anyone can track. So that's very, very interesting. Now, this trial is set to go ahead, and, of course, you say it's the last hope for basically a defense, you know, a guilty man, I think the expression is. Mangled it, probably. But he has some capable lawyers, like you say, including this Doug Peters. What did they decide to do, and what's the defense?
So, between the gun and the cell phone and the emails and all of his lies and the rental car, I mean, his goose is cooked, right? There's even more evidence. Remember they said he had a beard? Well, they found these fibers. It was clear that it was in the rental car. It was a fake beard. They were able to trace it back to a Halloween supply store. So, I mean, they had a mountain of evidence against Hemi. And they were in a corner. There's not much they could do. And so they decide a very, very risky gambit to launch an insanity defense. They claimed he was legally insane at the time of the killing, that he had suffered a undiagnosed bipolar disorder, that angels, spectral beings, spoke to him. And in particular, it was an angel who looked like Olivia Newton-John, but had a deep voice like Barry White, telling him things like, kill Rusty, the children, Rusty's children are in danger, blah, blah, blah. So these angels are telling him to do this, but he's nuts. He's got, this bipolar disorder, and it's all scrambled in his brain. And these angels are telling him and driving him to kill. Now, under the law, it's not enough to just have bipolar disorder. It's not enough to be flat out crazy. You have to, under the law, be so insane that you do not know the difference between right and wrong at the time that you commit the killing, that your insanity prevents you from knowing the difference between right and wrong. And contrary to popular belief, that is a very, very difficult thing to prove. And especially after the Hinckley thing with Reagan, they toughened those laws. And so it was a risky gambit because it's really hard to prove that somebody is not guilty by reason of insanity in any jurisdiction. But I think that's the only thing they had.
Now, in many cases, in any way that they would really defend this, I think they still would have taken the suspicion of police and other people in the media towards Andrea as part of their defense in terms of trying to bolster the defense. So they were trying to say that this man, she tried to say that he had delusions, that he thought he was in a more serious relationship than he actually was, that he thought because of the demon and the demon's instructions that the children were in danger, and so he had to kill Rusty and basically had no choice. He had to kill, so he was instructed to do this. And then this is backed up by this Dr. Flores. At first, they get the first diagnosis of the psychotic disorder, then this Dr. Flores. And so that's their defense, and then they back it up with another psychiatrist that agrees with Dr. Flores. What comes out in this, though, too, and it's reasonable that there is a sad story attached to his upbringing. So just briefly tell us what they did uncover in terms of his connection and his family's connection to the horror of the Holocaust.
Yeah, so I mean, as part of the psychological defense, they start looking into Rusty's life, and it is, he had a hard life. His father was a Holocaust survivor and survivor physically, but not mentally. And his father was never whole again after being incarcerated in a camp. And he would beat Hemi and physically and verbally abuse his boy. And Hemi always was trying to serve as the protector, I think, of his sister and his mother. And things were really bad for Hemi growing up. And he got shipped off to a boarding school in Israel, and there was some problem with it, and he ends up, in a bad situation there. And it's like the first time he starts having these delusions, and the first time he starts talking to angels. And this comes and goes throughout his life, and he's mounting. He's older, makes all this money, a couple $100,000, but a year, $170,000 a year, but you know, he's got all these financial problems. His marriage is in tatters. You know, he's got this mental illness. He's just under all kinds of pressure from within and from without. And you know, his defense is that Andrea was smart enough to kind of, if not know he was out and out crazy, certainly toyed with him and used him and played with his emotions and you know, put him up to this act, and that she took advantage of his weakness.
Now, she's an integral part of this trial, and they put her on the stand for a grueling few days. What's her demeanor like?
Well, remember,
how does she
even
fare?
Though they suspect, even though they suspect her of being involved, they haven't charged her with murder. Only Hemi is charged with a murder, and so he goes on trial, and she is the key witness. Now, remember, her whole thing is, I didn't know he did this. My God, he's crazy. How would I know that this guy would go off the handle and, you know, kill my husband? I'm as much a victim here as anybody. He's nuts. You know, he's crazy for me. How am I supposed to know this, right? That's her sort of defense. Well, she gets on the stand, and it's a disaster for her. That whole antagonistic, adversarial demeanor she had with police comes out at the trial. Remember, she's the prosecution witness. She is evasive. She is nasty. She is snide. She is really mean. And she won't answer simple questions. And, you know, she's very, very defensive. Now, she's taking the position, despite all these emails, despite the butt grabbing at the bar, despite the romantic dinners, despite the hotel rooms and all this stuff, she's taken the position they did not have an affair. And who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? And that's her position. I did not have an affair with this guy. I know it looks bad, but I didn't have an affair with him. And for some reason, this seems to be a critical issue for her, not finding justice for her dead husband. And so, you know, she is combative on the witness stand. Now, the trial, unfortunately for her, is being broadcast locally and I think on HLN, and so get some national coverage. It's all over the local area. It's on YouTube. And, you know, she's just not coming off well.
Now, she is also basically grilled to the inconsistencies that she has made in official statements, including her reaction to her husband's death and then the information that she conveys to her friend, which she couldn't have possibly known. And there are a few other crucial things that she really winces at and is defensive at trial when she is cornered regarding some of those things, doesn't she?
Yeah, and she doesn't have a good explanation for it. I think through it all, she has no good explanation for this. She's defensive, and through it out, through the whole thing, she never gives the perception of a woman who wants to find her husband's killer and bring him to justice. I mean, you would think she would go to the ends of the earth to help police. And you would think, okay, if she had an affair with this guy, you know, tough it out and admit it. Yeah, that's awful. You had an affair with somebody and then you went off and killed your husband. That sure looks bad. But why not just admit it? Just admit it. Okay, I did it. I had an affair. All right? But that doesn't mean I killed him. And keep in mind, nowhere in all these emails does she say to him, he killed my husband, so there's no smoking gun. It just, you have to wonder. She just starts making herself look even guiltier than the evidence would suggest.
They also have her with a major inconsistency that she was in Longmont, Colorado, and he was not with her. But
yeah.
Then they did evidence that showed contradicted her view or position, basically, that he didn't join her. And in fact, as you can tell our audience, what he actually did, so it's a complete opposite of what she had said.
Yeah, I mean, and during these questioning by police, she leaves out one major incident, and that's this business trip to Colorado. And he was there. Well, not only was he there, but he's leaving expressions of his love for her at the front desk. I think he went tried to get the front desk to buy her flowers. She may have, I can't remember if she rearranged the rooms, but somehow they ended up with adjoining rooms and then ends up they're on the same flight back sitting next to each other, you know. I mean, how do you forget this? And why do you lie about it?
And another difficult question for her, very especially difficult, was once she had told people that she thought Hemi was a suspect. She told somebody that he resembled the eyes of the sketch, and other people, they asked her, well, why didn't you call police? Well, if this was a man manipulating and a domineering force at work, why didn't you? What were her difficult answers to those questions?
Well, she doesn't have a good answer, and she bounces around and she basically just acts like, she's the victim here and that they're picking on her. Nobody seemed to know who was in that sketch except her, right? They have this police sketch of the killer, and she tells a friend, yeah, those eyes look like Hemi's, Nobody else says that. Nobody. None of the co-work, none of his nobody seems to think it's him except her, and then she says nothing. Then he, on top of all that, remember, sends her the Bruno Mars love song that leaves that part out, too. So, all of a sudden she's becoming an adversarial witness when she was supposed to be, she was supposed to be the prosecution's key witness. Very quickly, it looks like this trial is about her as much as it is about Hemi.
They also have it was very interesting to me, is because I've seen the rules myself being involved, that once you testify or before you testify, if you're a witness, you don't get to hear anybody's testimony. You're still under subpoena.
Oh.
You may be called back again. You could influence other witnesses with the information that you had that followed you. Tell us a little bit about this, the initial decision and then the reversal.
Well, as I recall, they were going to let her, you meant to refresh my recollection, but they were going to let her stay in or something, and then her friend testified. Remember the friend who she told was shot, and it was and this was the friend she confided marital problems to, and Andrea went on to deny this, and it became kind of a bad episode of The Real Housewives of Atlanta, between these two women, former friends, are now at each other's throat, and there's an ugly confrontation between Andrea and her former best friend at the courthouse. And, finally they had to kick, Andrea out of the trial. And none of this is reflecting well on her, and none of this is the kind of behavior you would think a grieving widow would exhibit.
Yeah. Basically, the prosecution ends and the defense wrap up their case.
Yeah.
She doesn't do well. Hemi doesn't take the stand. There is overwhelming physical evidence, all kinds of material evidence, digital phone calls, emails, eyewitness testimony, circumstantial. It's a slam dunk.
Yeah. Yeah, they find him guilty. They find him insane but guilty, which is interesting finding, but they just couldn't reach that threshold. Yes, he has mental illness. Yes, there were mitigating circumstances here in his brain, but he knew the difference between right and wrong when he pumped four bullets into Rusty Snyderman. He wasn't that impaired, and that really is the legal standard. Goes back hundreds of years. and they just couldn't overcome that hurdle.
Yeah, we have a different, we don't have that hurdle in Canada, but it's interesting where that definition includes not being able to discern right from wrong, and that is a tough hurdle, isn't it?
It is, and in the United States, after the assassination attempt on, I'm trying to remember which case it was. It was either the John Lennon assassination killing or the Reagan attempt. Right. There were some high-profile cases in which the gunman claimed insanity, and laws toughened here since then. It's just almost impossible to use an insanity defense.
Now, in terms of what happens with Andrea and what is the portrayal in the end after the trial concludes of her participation and role in this, how is she depicted?
Yeah, I mean, she obviously comes off badly. And initially she's charged with murder, conspiring to kill her husband. And nothing that happened at the trial made it any better on her. But the DA went through the evidence, and it was literally the day or two before her trial, the DA finally dropped the murder charge. Just didn't think he was going to be able to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think what was missing was that one email, that one thing, Hemi, kill my husband. Hemi, get him out of the picture. Hemi, I don't want him around. Any kind of even indirect indication from her to him that he should kill her. It just wasn't there. There was a lot of evidence that pointed to a possible affair, a lot of evidence that pointed to her lying about the affair, a lot of evidence of her, you know, not cooperating with police and obstructing justice. But, and, you know, I think people are still debating this. In the end, the DA just did not think he could prove that she conspired to murder her husband.
Did they undertake the normal procedure of, especially after this, after his conviction, regardless of whether they thought he was mentally ill and that, you know, that deduction, did they attempt to reach out to him for the normal maybe response that he might want to cooperate now?
Yeah.
Give evidence that he hadn't
they
given before.
A million times. You know, turn on Andrea, right? Did she tell you to do this? And God bless him, he refused to say that. That he did it. Angel told him to do it, you know. And it was only his lawyers who kind of implied that she toyed with his emotions, but he would not say that she put him up to it. Now, even if he did say that, they would have faced a lot of problems because here's a man whose defense was he's crazy, and now we're going to put him on the stand as a witness, you know. So it would have been problematic even if he did say it. But no, he never pointed the finger at Andrea.
What do you make of that?
Well, you can look at it two ways. But I think in the end, you have to take it at face value and say, well, she didn't. She never explicitly or implicitly told him to kill her husband. I think the larger question, and I've done books on several cases in which the wife or the girlfriend did not explicitly ask or direct the killer to kill somebody, but was able to use other means, sex, love, whatever, to get him to do it. And we enter a very dangerous area here, which is, you know, is it sexist to suggest that a woman can get her way, can get her man to do something without explicitly telling him? Can a woman use her body, her love, sex, whatever, to get a man to do something, but not have to tell him? Can she manipulate him in that way? Other cases I've written about, yes. The jury said, yep. No, she didn't say go kill him, but yeah, she used her body and used all these other feminine wiles to make it happen. In this case, the DA did not think there was enough there. So why did Hemi not? Maybe he's telling the truth. He's crazy, but he's not lying. That she never did tell him to kill my husband, you know, that he really did do it at the direction of the angels, that he really did think, you know, and he was very protective. I don't want to hurt her, you know. I'm trying to save her from this horrible man, Rusty.
It was interesting that, though, typically that there would be a story attached and there would be some evidence that at least he would say something, for example, like, well, she talked about the abuse of the children, the sexual abuse of her, or the verbal or physical abuse. That seemed to be suspiciously or conspicuously absent from this.
Yeah, it just wasn't there, you know. And even if she had lied to Hemi about something in the emails or whatever, what you see in the emails is, and, you know, this is my inference, but what you see is a woman who had been overshadowed by her husband, who had to give up her career for his, had to stay home, raise a couple of kids, while her husband went off this glamorous lifestyle in finance, that they had to move to, you know, this little suburb of Atlanta because his job took him there. She had to go. That she finally got back into the workplace. Keep in mind, this happened only a few months after, you know, she started working again. Got a really good job at General Electric. Finally living her potential, making good money, over $100,000, $140,000 a year. Got a good job, a good paycheck, is using her mind and her education. And her boss not only respects her, but loves her. Respects her as an employee and loves her as a woman. And she is flattered. And she is feeling good about where she is. But then she backs up and thinks this is wrong. You know, she's conflicted. And there's a lot of guilt. And so on the one hand, she likes the attention. And she likes the thrill of whatever it is. And whether it was an actual consummated affair or just heavy, heavy duty petting, either way, she at times seemed to like it and be energized and excited by it. And the fact that her marriage had problems, I think, added to that. But at the same time, then, she would express guilt, anger, frustration, leave me alone, that kind of thing. So, you know, is she toying with his emotions or is she trying to resolve her own? Does she want to have this affair or not want to have this affair? It doesn't seem like she could even articulate it. It depends on where you are at different points in time. So you see all this going on. What you don't see is a clear get rid of my husband, I want you to shoot and kill him. That doesn't come out.
How important do you think it is for the, you know, the evidence that showed that at some point she admitted that she's having an affair? He says, yeah, I'm having an affair, I have a mistress. But at some point he presents a scenario to her that, yes, we can live together, you know, even though he has kids, he has an ex-wife with children, mm-hmm. And she has children. He proposes something much more than an affair, doesn't he? I mean, he proposes marriage.
Yeah, he proposes, you know, getting married and going off into the sunset. Keep in mind, one of the business trips, the one where they were slow dancing and groping, happened right after he split up with his wife. So,
right.
You know, I think his feelings were a little more, to the extent you can, you know, break through all the mental issues. You know, he had big plans for her. I think she was not really clear what she was thinking, and it seemed to change at different points in time. You know, how do you explain why she would be so defensive about all this? And you have to ask yourself, well, is she defensive because she's embarrassed by the affair and embarrassed by what her family and friends would think about it? Doubly embarrassed because she's having an affair with a guy who is so nuts that he, you know, killed her husband. I mean, that's embarrassing and devastating, point in pride. Is she defining an affair as actual sex? I mean, maybe they never actually slept with each other. Maybe it was all just romance, right? Sitting in bed watching romantic movies, but never actually consummating. Or maybe, I don't know, you know, how in her mind, how she even defines what an affair actually is. But you have to keep wondering, why would she be so defensive? Why would she be putting up, you know, I mean, to the point where she's obstructing justice? You know, in the end, she was more embarrassed than she would ever have been before. So is she hiding something criminal, or is she just hiding something embarrassing?
Is there a possibility that she knew that her job would be terminated because it really was, or it seemed to be dependent on Hemi Newman?
They crossed boundaries while they were, whether the affair was consummated or not, they were crossing employer boundaries on these trips. And it was consensual, so she wasn't going to say anything. She wasn't going to, she did these things. She probably felt guilty, certainly expressed guilt after some of it. But at the same time, she was not going to inform HR because, you know, he wasn't sexually harassing her. You know, she never claimed that. And that whatever it was they were doing, it was with her full consent.
What I'm asking is there a possibility that she, a good possibility that she didn't know, and there is no evidence that she knew of his plans to kill her husband, that what once after it seems evidence that she may have suspected, and then after that may have suspected and then detoured the police and the investigation, it seemed, purposely, is there a motive for that $2 million in an insurance policy?
Yeah, I don't think the insurance in this case was the issue. I really don't. $2 million seems like a lot, but when you're sitting in a big, you know, million-dollar house, mortgage and all this, I just for people of their station in life, it's not that big. It's big, but it's not that big. And I understand. Some people get murdered for a pair of tennis shoes, and then you say, well, $2 million isn't. I don't think that was it. As for what Andrea knew and when she knew it, I don't know. I think you can make a really good case that the second she found out her husband was killed, she knew exactly who did it. Exactly. What I can't get past is how she knew he was shot. And she didn't just say it to one person, right? I mean, it's in a text message to a coworker. My husband's been shot. And I can't get past the fact that she expressed this around the time that she's talking to Hemi. And did he tell her in a conversation afterwards, I shot your husband? And she's like, you know, having one of those, oh gosh, you know, moments. And she's putting it all together, right? And even though she knows she never told him to do it, everyone's going to think she did. And right. She starts thinking about the business trips and the romantic dinners and all that stuff. And now it's like, okay, now she's in trouble. Even though you can make a really good case that she never did tell him to do it and probably didn't even want him to do it, right? I mean, I don't think she even wanted her husband dead. That doesn't make sense.
Right.
But now she knows she's in big, 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 big trouble. And it looks really bad. And then part of me thinks she wanted police. She didn't want to have to tell them, right? She didn't want to have to lay out this whole tawdry affair. She wanted police to figure it out on their own. Because she did tell them in the very beginning, yes, it was my boss, you know, Hemi Newman. You know, she didn't have to say anything. When they said, has anybody expressed, you know, so I don't know. And I think she has, remember, she's in a technical field. She understands that they can get to her email and her voicemail and all this sort of stuff. And then they can find information. They can look at the credit. She has some kind of basic knowledge that there's a digital trail. So she's got to say enough, you know, to have some credit. So, I don't know. I think there was a lot of panic going on. I really think in the end, the DA, although it was not a popular, made the right decision. I don't think there was enough evidence to charge her with murder. I think there was enough evidence to charge her with obstruction of justice and lying to police and all the charges that she ultimately was put on trial for. But I just don't, you know, I don't think it was there. I don't think it's there.
Now, despite this, I love this term, vigorous defense for the insanity defense for him, but insane but guilty, what do you think about his real... Again, they decided that he wasn't insane by definition, but this seems, all this mental illness and reporting of it seems to be awfully convenient, and there is a lot of, it seems,
first of all, it wasn't until his defense started getting feedback on the gun and all this evidence that all of a sudden the insanity came out, right? It didn't come out in the very beginning. He wasn't insane right after he was... arrested. It wasn't until they found out about the gun and emails and all this other thing. So it does kind of smack of some, you know, kind of having to cook up a defense. At the same time, I don't doubt for a second that angels were telling him to shoot, you know, Rusty. I think he was crazy. Most people
really
say if you commit a murder, by very definition, that's an insane act. You know, just by doing it. Same people don't go around killing other people. People who are unimpaired don't go around killing other people. The cold-blooded diabolical killer, I just don't think really exists. And then you can argue that person's even insane. So, but it does. It did come out as awfully convenient. And, you know, a lot of it didn't quite hold up. And, you know, it was kind of dueling experts there near the end. You know, you pay an expert enough money, they'll say anything in court. But I think he's clearly got severe mental illness. But severe mental illness is not the standard in the United States for an acquittal. People who are on drugs, right? I mean, really impaired while on drugs or drunk, get convicted of murder. And if you're mentally impaired, you get convicted of murder. It just didn't rise to that very, very high level.
It's very interesting. In your book, you have all the information from these psychiatrists that that assessed Hemi in prison, the preliminary, and then the major interviews with Dr. Flores, and then, of course, another interview with the other defense psychiatrist. What I found was really crucial and very, very interesting in this book was he talked to the prosecution psychiatrist. Well, it wasn't a psychiatrist per se. They tried to attack her credibility, but the story he gave her was, I think, crucial at trial because it talked about the pre-planning. He thought he had somebody he could do a similar story with the other psychiatrist, but he gave her quite a bit of a different story, and that didn't help him at trial.
And it speaks to the premeditation. And remember, let's go all the way back to the beginning of this interview. We talked about the Mexican-looking guy who was lurking around an air conditioner or something at the house, the one who Rusty called. Well, that was Hemi, you know. And he was lurking around the house. That was a day he was going to kill. And there's still a lot of unanswered questions, right? How did he know he was going to be dropping off the kid that day, right? How did he know what Rusty's schedule was going to be? How did he know, you know, how did he know all these things? and unless Andrea told him. And, you know, there was clearly some planning and premeditation. And you have to wonder, did Andrea really think it was some Mexican guy lurking around behind the house, or did she know right away that it was Hemi? Yet she didn't say anything. And she raised the specter of the anonymous, mysterious Mexican, which would be, you know, in that kind of community, would really put people off on the wrong track. So, you know, he just couldn't reach that level of not knowing. With all that kind of planning, he wasn't continuously, constantly crazy, right? There were long periods of lucidity when he knew what he was doing was wrong, and he did it anyway, and that's what the legal standard is.
It was very interesting, too. The one other thing was that when you talked about the schedule, but also I think even more important for me, was that there was an escape route through the woods. There was a sidewalk there that unless he, again, he must have stalked her for sure, but at least he was told that there was an escape route through that woods.
Yeah,
he'd been there before.
Yeah,
so.
You know, the house kind of butts up against a grove of trees, and it's even though it's in suburban Atlanta, it's a very kind of woodsy area, and these are big lots and lots of trees and pathways and things. And how would he know, you know, how would he know? I think one other thing, which I raised it in the book, which I found very interesting. You're asking questions about, well, you know, what was going on in Andrea's mind? We had all this evidence about what went through Hemi's head, multiple shrinks talking to him, but we don't have a psychological profile of Andrea. She didn't raise a psychological defense. We don't know. It'd be very fascinating to find out what the psychiatrist and psychologist would have made of her. We don't know. We know what was going through Hemi's head, or at least has some very strong clues, but we don't know what was going through hers.
Yeah. Yeah, more questions, certainly. I want to thank you very much, Michael Fleeman, for coming on and talking about Crazy for You, True Story of a Family Man's Murder, Wife's Secret, and a Deadly Obsession. Fascinating book, fascinating. For those that might want to take a look at this, do you have a Facebook page and a website? Tell us about that, please.
I do. You can go on michaelfleeman.com. It's my name. You can go on Amazon and punch in my last name, Fleeman, and my profile. I have a bio page in Amazon, and you can link to it through my website. You can go on Michael Fleeman on Facebook or the True Crime page on Facebook. All of those things will lead you to me. And if you want to reach out to me, go onto my website, shoot me a note. There's a contact me, and that goes right into my email inbox. So I'd love to hear from everybody.
Thank you very much, Michael. You have a great evening. And also for fans, join me on my personal Dan Zapansky Facebook page for comments on this show and others. Thank you. Have a great night, Michael. Thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Good night.